Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Undocumented parents and the Supreme Court. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The fate of President Obama's most sweeping immigration action and the fate of millions of people now rests in the hands of the Supreme Court. The president's 2014 executive order would delay deportations and grant work permits to some 4 million undocumented parents of children born in the U.S. But 26 Republican-led states challenged Obama's policy as presidential overreach. The case lands in a presidential campaign already swirling with talk of a wall on the Mexican border. Will the shorthanded high court end in a 4-4 deadlock? Also, on today's Talking Point, the fight for cruelty-free eggs and meat in the food industry. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Back with To the Point, I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, the Supreme Court heard arguments today that could decide the fate of President Obama's most sweeping executive action on immigration. His program would delay deportations for some 4 million immigrants. 26 states and Republican leaders say the Constitution doesn't grant him the power to do this. More on that later. And on today's Talking Point, the political cage fight over eggs. Does cage-free mean healthier and more humane? First, this news update. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in Iraq today, and he announced the U.S. will deploy 200 more troops, this time close to the front lines of the conflict with ISIS. The U.S. military is also for the first time using Apache helicopters against the militant group in Iraq. And both actions are reportedly part of a buildup to help Iraq retake the city of Mosul. Eric Schmidt is the national security correspondent for The New York Times, and welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Barbara.
And you're joining us from D.C., I should say. But what kind of troops are being deployed to Iraq this time around?
These are largely special forces that are going to be helping train and advise the Iraqis as they get closer to a final showdown in Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq and the largest stronghold that the Islamic State has in the country. The Iraqis have been making slow progress moving in toward Mosul over the last several months. But the Pentagon has been pressing to move more advisors closer to the fight, which is also happening in this announcement today from Mr. Carter, basically allowing them to advise still not frontline combat, but a little bit closer. And as you mentioned, there'll be an initial 200 or so additional advisors that will also be manning some additional artillery that will be brought in. And as you mentioned, the Apaches, the very effective killer helicopters that the United States Army has there in Iraq.
And what does all this signal about the escalation of U.S. involvement in the conflict with ISIS in Iraq?
Well, what it signals is that we're at the beginning of a new phase here. The Pentagon last week talked about the end of phase one, that is weakening ISIS by the series of airstrikes they've conducted over nearly 2 years now. And now they're basically trying to go and isolate the two main centers that ISIS has, Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in eastern Syria. This deployment today announced is focusing on the Mosul operation. So it's the final showdown, if you will, in Mosul is still probably months away. But this additional firepower from the United States, as well as pushing advisors closer to the fight, signals, an additional risk on the part of the United States, but also pushing the Iraqis toward a final state of trying to push the Islamic State out of Iraq entirely.
Well, you wrote in your piece about this on Friday that announcing or even proposing increased American assistance is a delicate diplomatic task that could further imperil the tenuous political position of Iraq's prime minister. So what political fallout might there be for him of today's announcement and of the operation there?
That's right. And the defense secretary was careful. Apparently, these announcements today came after discussions with Prime Minister Abadi, basically seeing what the political traffic in Iraq could bear. As you mentioned, he's under a lot of fire from home within his own Shia group, ethnic group there, in terms of not kowtowing too much to the Americans. But obviously, the Iraq needs American assistance on the ground as they push forward and try and defeat the Islamic State.
Well, there's been a concern over a lack of transparency from the U.S. military about exactly where troops are being placed as the president has increased the level of U.S. involvement in the region. Is this an attempt at more transparency, do you think?
Perhaps. I think I'm still somewhat skeptical in just kind of the way the administration now has accounting rules for troops there. Right now, for instance, the so-called ceiling of American troops in the in Iraq is just over 4,000 now, but because of the accounting rules that count different troops differently in terms of whether they're part-time, full-time, according to the Pentagon standards, there could be as many as an additional 1,000 troops or a total of 5,000 in-country right now. So I think the White House is very reluctant to go along with some of these troop increases that have been requested by the commanders on the ground. The president, of course, has been very careful to say this is a fight that's up to the Iraqis. The U.S. will assist it, but there will be no boots on the ground, combat boots on the ground. But already the United States has deployed commando teams that are up and running on the ground there. So it's, you know, the definition of combat's gotten a little bit opaque, I think, in terms of what the White House is offering.
And lastly, could you put this in a broader context for us? As you say, the U.S. military is saying that we're in the second phase of operations against the Islamic State in Iraq. But where does the conflict stand in the broader picture of the militant group's foothold in places like Libya and its terrorist capability in Europe?
Exactly. This is just one component. Obviously, it's a very important one. This is the Islamic State's state, their stronghold, and it's Syria and Iraq. It's where they derive most of their power and their revenues from. But as you mentioned, they've been able to very effectively export terror cells into the heart of Europe with the attacks in Paris and in Brussels. They have at least 8 very effective affiliates in places like Libya, West Africa, and in the Sinai. And so the fight against ISIS is a long way from being over. Even if the campaign is taking a new phase in Iraq and Syria.
Eric Schmidt with the New York Times, thank you so much for taking the time today.
You're welcome.
And when we come back, the Supreme Court takes on the case against President Obama's most sweeping executive action on immigration. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. Today, the Supreme Court heard a case that could determine the fate of President Obama's most sweeping executive action on deportation. It would also drastically change the lives of some 4 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. And the president's plan would delay the deportation of parents of children who are U.S. citizens or permanent legal residents and offer them temporary work permits. But it's been on hold since it was announced 18 months ago because of court challenges, leaving immigrants across the nation in limbo. The majority of them have been in the country for 10 years or more. And Robert Barnes joins us now. He covers the Supreme Court for the Washington Post. He's nonpartisan and he understands the court better than most. It is so good of you to join us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Barbara.
Remind us, before we get into the legal ins and outs of this case, exactly what executive actions we're discussing here and what the president has already put into place before he got to DAPA.
Well, I think that you described it well, that there are a number of programs in which the executive has decided that there are certain immigrants that shouldn't be deported, or at least should not be a priority for deportation. And so one was a couple of years ago, children who were brought here when they were very young, wasn't their decision to come, offered them some way to stay in the country. Then this one sort of extends that to their parents. And so there are about 4 million people who would be affected by this. Most of them live in California, or the largest section, I should say. The second largest lives in Texas. And Texas and 25 other states have challenged that, saying that the way the administration did this, it doesn't just delay or defer deportation. It gives them work authorizations, and it entitles them to a number of things that government provides, and that is beyond the president's powers to do, and that he did it after Congress specifically refused to go along with these plans. So that's where it stands. It's once again another case that we are kind of familiar with at the Supreme Court now, that pits the government's sort of ambitious president's ambitious social agenda against Republicans who are opposed to it.
And one of those public benefits being, for instance, a driver's license, and that's exactly why Texas says it has the legal standing to intervene. It's making a case concerning the cost of those driver's licenses. Correct?
Yes, that's right. They say that their law allows those who are here authorized to work to get driver's licenses. It would be a big increase in the number, and that it would cost the state money. The Obama administration says, well, that's an injury that you took on when you decided to do this, and that's not enough to get you standing to challenge this. But under questioning, the Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, representing the government, acknowledged that if Texas didn't offer driver's licenses to these folks, the government would probably sue them. So, you know, the question of standing is going to be important. And I think those of us who cover the court in this sort of unusual period after the death of Justice Scalia, a 4-4 decision would keep in place the lower court's decision that said this program couldn't be implemented. I think this court's very sensitive to not letting too many of those cases get decided 4-4. And so I think it will try to find some sort of narrow compromise one way or another that avoids that real stark ideological divide on the court.
Did you see any evidence of that in the 90 Minutes this morning?
There was some evidence about, you know, could there be a way that the president has this right to decide who to defer deportation to, which groups would not be priorities for deportation. But at the same time, it wouldn't mean that they are sort of automatically authorized to get work permits or some of the other benefits that the states are worried about. That would kind of blunt the intent of the president's program, but it would be a compromise. I think another thing to think about here is, you know, time is running out on this administration. And if it's a Democrat who's elected next, they have both of the candidates have talked about trying to expand upon this program, maybe doing it even bigger. The Republican candidates have said that they will get rid of it. And so we are also in a very unusual time right now.
So where, if the court decides on a narrow, very narrow ruling, where does that leave this fundamental question of executive action and whether the president has overreached presidential powers?
Well, that's a good question, and there wasn't a whole lot to that today. I think that the court, seeing that it is split, 4-4 on that kind of basic question, might look for another way out. You know, the court added the question about whether or not the president was fulfilling his constitutional duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. That was back when Justice Scalia was around, who you would think would be particularly interested in that question, and he's not here there. He's not here now.
And before we have to let you go back to work, I know you had a piece on Sunday that I read about the politics of this immigration decision,
yes.
and you've somewhat alluded to that, but specifically how it's playing out in, say, blue state California, where here we have 1 in 6 workers are undocumented, and immigrant families have put down very deep roots in the state, and that contrasts to many red states or even the situation in Texas. So, what's your sense of how far apart is the country on the issue?
I thought it was very interesting that, you know, California, that has the largest concentration of these undocumented immigrants, very embracing of the president's program. They sort of say, we've seen the reality. We fought this battle 20 years ago. It's not going to change. And so we need to find some way to accommodate all of these people that now have children who've graduated from high school and college. And we need to do something about that. Texas, on the other hand, very much opposed to it, thinks that it's an overreach by the federal government. And it was sort of striking to me the differences between that blue state and that red state.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time for this today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Robert Barnes, he covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post. And turning now to Josh Blackman. He's professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. And he helped draft an amicus brief in this case, United States versus Texas. He joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, you were in the court today. What stands out for you so far from the arguments this morning?
So I think the first thing that stands out was that there was a lot of question of how Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy would approach this issue. I think from the early moments, both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy seemed pretty convinced that Texas was sufficiently injured to have standing. At one point, the chief said that this is a catch-22. If Texas decides not to give them a driver's license, they will get sued. And if they decide to give them a driver's license, they think they're engaging in an illegal act or within a legal policy. And also Justice Kennedy even seemed to suggest that there may be constitutional problems if Texas discriminates against these immigrants and doesn't give them licenses. So I don't think that standing will be the dispute, and I think I agree with your previous guests on that. The biggest issue to look forward to is the issue of lawful presence. The government's memorandum announcing this policy said that the aliens who get this will be, quote, lawfully present, and the justices spent maybe 75% of the day discussing the term lawful presence. Now, the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, made a proposal. He said, well, wait a minute. What if you take a red pencil, that's what he said. What if you take a red pencil and you strike through the word lawfully present? Then would the policy be okay? And Justice Kagan was pressing this point for nearly 45 minutes, virtually with every single advocate who was up there. The problem with this, as Justice Alito and a few others addressed, is that there are other provisions in the law that actually rely on this granting of lawful presence, specifically granting of Social Security, granting of work authorization. So it's not enough to just take a red pencil and strike out the key phrase. Also, I should remind your listeners, this has shades of the Chief Justice's 2012 decision in the Obamacare case, where he basically took something called a penalty, crossed it out, and made it to a tax. Or last year, we had the Obamacare case, King v. Burwell, where it said established by the state, crossed it out, made established by the federal government. I think the key difference, though, between those Obamacare cases and this immigration case is those are statutes enacted by Congress. There's democratic accountability to Congress. Here we are dealing with an executive memorandum by the president.
And by lawful presence, you mean a legal status in the states to immigrants and whether the president has the power to do that?
Right. And that's the entire issue. What is lawful presence? The government keeps arguing that lawful presence has no meaning.
In fact,
they tried to suggest it means tolerated presence, which is frustrating.
And this gets us to this issue of whether the president has overreached in this action, which is something that you address in the amicus brief that you help write. You liken President Obama to King George III, whose behavior, of course, incited Americans to revolt and ultimately declare independence. And the president himself made some allusions to this before he announced his executive action. Why don't we listen now to what the president said in an interview back in 2012, describing his limitations at being able to do anything to stop deportations.
You know, we live in a democracy. We don't live in a monarchy. I'm not the king. I'm the president. And so I can only implement those laws that are passed through Congress.
So take it away. In the president's own words, why don't you explain your analogy and why it still applies?
As Mel Brooks said, it's good to be the king. So the short answer is our Constitution was framed against the backdrop of the Stuart monarchs. King George III would often suspend the laws. And, in fact, he would demand that when the colonies enact laws, they include a provision saying, okay, you have to suspend this. And the framers of our Constitution viewed this as a blurring of the lines between the executive and the legislative. So I argued in the brief of the Cato Institute, Professors Randy Barnett and Jeremy Rapkin and Elise Shapiro, is that the president does not have the power to make laws. Deeming people who are here unlawfully as lawful presidents is a way to bypass the laws of Congress. This is not a routine exercise of prosecutorial discretion. This is actually trying to adjust the status. And if I may, we actually had arguments not just from the government but from a group of Jane Does. These are immigrants who live in Texas who would stand to benefit from this policy. The reason why they're in this case was that they would rely on this to make their lives better. I agree. This is not some sort of short-term temporary solution that could be removed at any time. The purpose of this, as the president said, is to get people out of the shadows. Now, as a policy matter, I agree with that. But Congress didn't, and Congress didn't vote for his bill. And the president can't simply sidestep through this so-called prosecutorial discretion.
Josh Blackman with the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Let's bring in Elizabeth Wydranow, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which is a D.C.-based think tank and law firm. And thanks for being here today, Elizabeth.
Great to be with you. And I enjoyed hearing Josh talk about King George, but I think he wants to talk about anything other than the actual law, because that doesn't really help his case. But it was very interesting.
Well, help us understand, though, Obama clearly didn't agree with taking executive actions on immigration, at least at first. So why the movement?
You know, the president cannot permanently change the immigration laws. That's absolutely true. But what the immigration laws that are passed by Congress clearly do is give the executive authority to establish, quote, national immigration enforcement policies and priorities, end quote. And that's exactly what he did with DAPA, by saying what we're going to do is say that families should stay together, you're going to be a low priority for removal. And it's just absolutely wrong that, as Josh said, that they're changing some sort of lawful status. That was clarified today in argument. And so I think that was why so much of the time was spent on that, was to clarify. And I thought the Solicitor General did a great job of clarifying that undocumented immigrants who are afforded deferred action under the DAPA program, they are still subject to removal proceedings at any time if those enforcement priorities that Congress explicitly delegates discretion to set to the executive, if those change. So what the Solicitor General was clarifying when he said, you can take those words out of the memorandum, out of the DAPA memorandum, because it doesn't matter, because this is just simply setting common sense enforcement priorities that when you have limited resources given to the executive, you can only deport a very small fraction of the people here who are here without documentation. It just simply makes sense, and presidents from both parties for decades have done the same thing, and I thought that the Solicitor General did a great job of pointing that out. Justice Sotomayor followed, again, very powerfully by saying, you know, George W. Bush did this, George H.W. Bush did this in the Family Fairness Program, and, you know, the president was acting within the discretion that Congress gives to him because there are foreign policy concerns, humanitarian concerns, and this is just simply a common sense approach that follows on legal precedent and other precedents from administrations of both parties.
Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a D.C.-based think tank and law firm. We're going to go to break now, and then we're going to continue our conversation about the case currently before the Supreme Court, which could radically change the lives of some 4 million immigrants and their families in the U.S. And later on our talking point, in November, Massachusetts might follow California in banning eggs that aren't cruelty-free. But should they? The debate about inhumane treatment of animals in big food. That's ahead on To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
And we're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Warren Olney. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the case before the Supreme Court today. It's a challenge to President Obama's most sweeping executive order on immigration, which would delay deportations for more than 4 million undocumented parents of legal U.S. residents. 26 states are claiming that the policy amounts to presidential overreach. And supporters of the president's executive orders argue that it's in keeping with the reality of America today, where the vast majority of these workers are threatened with deportation, have been in this country for a decade or longer, have steady employment, and have raised children who are now permanent residents or American citizens. And they're people like Maria Bilbao, for example. She and her family came to the U.S. in 2001 from Argentina. They now live in Miami. Her son, Tomas, became a legal permanent resident 5 years ago, and he's applied to become a U.S. citizen. And thank you so much for coming on our program.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the politics, let me ask you, why did you come to the U.S.? What brought you here?
It was a big, big crisis in 2001 in Argentina, and my husband has her mother and her brother and her sister here. So we came here for a better opportunity. For us and for myself.
And you've been here for some 15 years now?
For 15 years. We tried to apply for Mauro's brother and sister. They were citizens, but the line was 22 years, and we had to came back to Argentina and wait there. And we decided to stay here.
So you're living undocumented. Give us a sense of what that's like for you, just how it affects your life, what you do or you don't do. Because of fear.
It's like you live in fear. You live in fear of deportation. You have to drive without a driving license, and you're always scared. And, you know, one day everything that you were dreaming and everything that you achieved here in this country is over.
What do you deny yourself because you don't have papers?
I bet the job, maybe. I have been working like a housekeeper, like a domestic worker since I came to this country. And I always think that because of people like me, there are millions of American families that can go out every single day to work, knowing that the kids are being cared of, their food are cooking, their house are cleaning. So I really think that we are people that deserve relief and deserve an opportunity.
And you support the president's DAPA plan that's before the court?
Yes, of course.
Because some people don't think it goes far enough, but you support it. What would you say, what would you tell the Supreme Court if you had stood before it this morning?
I'm sure that I deserve that because I know that I'm hardworking people. We are hardworking people, and I know that I contribute to this country a lot, a lot. We pay our taxes. And you know, we know that the law is our side, and it's our side of President Obama. So I know we are going to win. We were fighting for DAPA for a long, long time, and that was our victory. And we are going to still fighting for it.
Maria Bilbao of Miami, who's directly affected by the Supreme Court's decision today. Let's turn now to Frank Sherry. He's founder and executive director of America's Voice, an immigration reform group, and welcome to The Point.
Hi, thanks for having me, Barbara.
So you talk to people every day like Maria. How representative is her story?
Very representative. I mean, the undocumented immigrants who would benefit from the president's executive actions are very much like her and her family. They've been here for many years, work hard. They have kids that are Americans, either permanent residents or citizens, and they're threatened with being separated every day. If they get, you know, a small accident or get pulled over by a policeman, they don't have their license, they get caught up in the deportation machinery, and they can be shipped away from their family and out of the country within 48 to 72 hours. So it does cause a tremendous amount of fear within the families. On the other hand, they're tremendously resilient, work hard, want to become American, and are kind of perplexed that they feel American, they do what Americans want them to do, and yet we haven't been able to seem to come up with a federal policy that says you can be formally recognized as the Americans you already are in practice.
Well, what do you say to people who disagree that the law is on her side? That she's here illegally, we can't take everyone.
Well, of course we can't take everyone. I mean, ultimately the solution is for Congress and the president to pass a comprehensive immigration reform package that combines enforcement at the border and at the workplace with expanded legal immigration and a legalization program so that people like Maria and others who qualify would be able to come forward and meet a variety of criteria, study English, background checks, et cetera, maintain a good work record and eventually be able to stay here. That's an approach that 75% of Americans support. Unfortunately, the Republicans in the Congress have consistently opposed it. They've even shifted further to the right as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz have become the standard bearers of the party. And all the governors who sued the Obama administration for taking this executive action are, in fact, Republicans. I mean, I think what you have is a partisan dispute about what to do with 11 million undocumented immigrants in America that's ended up in the Supreme Court. And I associate myself with the comments of Elizabeth and others who say, wait a minute, why is this political dispute that is best left to the political branches being refereed? It's a policy matter in which voters elect representatives to make decisions. And it's pretty clear to us that what the president has done is no different than what presidents have done for the last 60 years. I mean, there have been large groups of refugees and immigrants that have been brought into the country on the basis of executive action, and it's been entirely non-controversial. Think of George H.W. Bush. He accepted Chinese students after Tiananmen Square. He also started a program for family unity that would have benefited 40% of the undocumented immigrants in America. There was no controversy. I think at this point what we have is a partisan political dispute over a contentious policy issue that doesn't belong in the courts, belongs in the Congress, and if the Congress doesn't act, the executive has the authority with congressional authority to take certain steps, and they've, I think, gone as far as they think they can within those limits, and I, quite frankly, would be very surprised if the court ruled against the government. I think it's likely that even the conservative justices will find a way to say, you know, the administration is using well-established discretionary authority, and if we say Texas can sue on this, we'll have every agency decision in the federal government wind up in the Supreme Court.
Well, turning back to Josh Blackman with the South Texas College of Law, clearly there is sympathy here with immigrants, and Frank Sherry mentioned 75% of Americans support coming to a solution on this partisan dispute, but that isn't necessarily the issue for you here, right? You see this as a president acting outside of his constitutional power?
Absolutely. And I think it's worth stressing what's good for the goose is sauce for the gander. The sorts of broad plenary powers that President Obama has exercised over immigration, effectively saying, well, Congress hasn't really imposed any preferences, so I shall exercise my discretion. That same power could be used by President Trump in the exact opposite direction. A policy to exclude people of a certain religious or racial group within this sort of authority. I think the immigrant community should be very weary of asserting the president has this much authority and saying Congress has imposed no sorts of restraints. Now, to go to some of the specifics that Frank Sherry and I, we've done this a few times before, when the president grants deferred action, when the president grants relief after Tiananmen Square, that's under his Article II powers with foreign affairs, so it's quite different. Second, President George H.W. Bush, and this is a point the Solicitor General, I think, misstated today, President George H.W. Bush used a process called voluntary departure, which is different than deferred action. Also, it didn't impact 40%. Only about 50,000 people actually signed up. That 40% number has been debunked many times by various fact checkers. So really what we're having here is an unprecedented exertion of executive power. There's no precedent for this. Congress has not acquiesced to it. And to make the point even more finally, Congress, the United States House of Representatives, filed a brief argument today saying that this is not consistent with our laws. We should be very, very careful before we defer to this sort of exercise of power, because we don't know how the next president will exercise it.
Elizabeth Weidra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, I want to give you a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one thing with respect to future presidents, we also have other provisions of the Constitution that protect people and equality based on religion or other protected attributes that we value and respect in our country. So I think that, you know, recognizing that the whole Constitution is at play here is important. But I think, you know, one thing that's really important to note is that there is a discretionary grant to the executive from Congress here. So, you know, we can talk about political disputes over what the president did and whether they think it's a good idea. But, you know, we have bipartisan support for what the president did here, you know, or at least saying even if you disagree with it, he had the authority to do it under the laws that are written. And while it's true that we did see some House Republicans filing a brief and coming into court saying they disagree with the president and think what he did is somehow overreaching, there are also the folks who were signed on to the brief that I filed who wrote these laws and say, actually, this is wholly in line with the discretion that we give to the executive because the president needs to take into account foreign policy concerns, humanitarian concerns, and frankly, it just comes down to a common sense exercise of discretion when you only have limited funds to deport a certain number of people, even if you want to deport everybody. Congress didn't give DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, which enforces immigration law, they didn't give them enough money to do that. So recognizing that fact, I think almost everyone can agree that it makes sense to focus on deporting people who provide a potential security threat and not deporting people who are working hard, people who have family members who are citizens, who are contributing to our economy and our communities.
Well, Frank Sherry with the immigration reform group America's Voice, say the court allows the president's executive action to stand. How will undocumented workers react? Will they be afraid to come forward given the uncertainty around the presidential election and the next administration?
Yeah, it's a good question because we're expecting a decision by the end of June. Obviously, there's only 7 months or so left in the Obama presidency. But our understanding is that the Department of Homeland Security is prepared to ramp up very quickly and begin implementation of the program. And I would expect you would see very long lines of people coming forward, even though there's the uncertainty because the next president can, on day one, rescind what is an executive action. Both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz have promised to do so. But I think many people, think that a Democrat is going to win the presidency. But more importantly, I think they want to come forward, get the reprieve from deportation, obtain a work permit, get a driver's license, and begin to lead a life of dignity and freedom that's been denied them because of their lack of status. And I think the bet will be on many, many people will come forward. I'm sure some will hold back and wait. But I think the bet that most people will make is that it's a lot harder to take away something that's already been received than it is to cut it off for people who haven't yet applied. But I do think there's going to be a lot of uncertainty overhanging the implementation of the program. But there is such a pent-up demand on the part of people like Maria and families like hers all over America to come forward, to be known to the government, to prove that they've been paying taxes and working hard and that they haven't committed any crimes and that they deserve to be acknowledged, tolerated presence, I guess is what the government's calling it. It's certainly no guarantee of permanent residence, and we still need legislation to actually fix this problem. But I'm going to be encouraging the loved ones in my life who are eligible to come forward and apply.
Josh Blackman with the South Texas College of Law and Cato Institute. I'd like you to weigh in on this too.
So I think the long and short of it is that I think we all agree that the outcome of the next election will decide this issue. It's no coincidence that the president announced this in November 2014 after the election. He was attempting to bypass a Congress that didn't give him the bill he wanted. What he wasn't anticipating was that a federal court would enjoin the policy and put it on hold. So this would basically force him to rush this issue into the last few months of his administration. Regardless of what happens here, it'll be up to the next president to decide. I think it's also worth noting that both Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders have both pledged that they would expand DAPA to the parents of the Dreamers, the parents of the beneficiaries. What's troubling about that is the Obama Office of Legal Counsel said that would be illegal, that the deferred action could not be stretched that far. So we're already seeing in the next instance the next presidential candidates on the left are saying they would go even beyond what President Obama has done. So it always sounded a cautionary note. At one point, it was in vogue for liberals to attack the unitary executive, but now when one is in office, he's become the left's best friend.
And Elizabeth Weidrich, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, I'm thinking Justice Roberts has gotten a lot of flack from conservatives for siding with Obama in some recent cases. And he's also said that he doesn't want this court to be seen as a forum where partisan matters would be worked out. So which way do you think he's going to go?
Yes, you know, Chief Justice Roberts has made very clear that he doesn't want the Supreme Court to be seen as just another political body where, people vote on party lines. So I think that it will be important for him here to take that into account when he looks at his past jurisprudence. He has been very strict about keeping the courthouse doors closed to people who do not have concrete injuries that he sees as being able to get them into court. And again, that's that standing point, which is kind of a very legal procedural ground. But I think he's going to want to follow the law very strictly here so he and the court won't be accused of simply playing politics. And you've seen him do that in the Affordable Care Act cases and in, frankly, a very similar context from a few years ago when the court considered Arizona's SB 1070 Show Us Your Papers law. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy joined with the more liberal justices. And you might see something similar here because this does look very much like a political dispute dressed up in litigation clothing. And the Chief Justice does not like that. And he doesn't like the court being treated like a legislature when really they're there to decide legal issues. And I think when he looks at those legal issues, he's going to find it very hard to rule against the administration in this case. And the Solicitor General did a great job of really hammering that home today. You know, he gave his rebuttal right after the lawyer for the House Republicans gave her argument. And I think the contrast between the two, you know, hers was very much something that you might see on, you know, primetime news talking points. And the Solicitor General came back with a very matter-of-fact legal argument saying that this is what the president has done with the DAPA program is fully in line with congressional statutes granting discretion to the executive. And frankly, Texas's argument is really a political one that doesn't belong in the court in the first place. And I think the Chief Justice will be very sympathetic to those sorts of arguments, or at least give them a very fair hearing.
And we're going to leave it there until we get a decision from this court, and then we'll call you all back. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. Appreciate it very much. We heard from Elizabeth Weidrich, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, also Robert Barnes, who covers the Supreme Court for The Washington Post, Josh Blackman with the South Texas College of Law in Houston, Maria Bilbao of Miami, and Frank Sherry, founder and director of America's Voice. And in a moment, the cruelty-free food movement moves to Massachusetts. Will voters go for cage-free eggs or bust? That's next on To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney with today's Talking Point. How should we treat animals in the food industry? Voters in Massachusetts will decide on this in November. They're facing a ballot question whether the state should ban the sale of eggs, pork products, or veal from animals who are too tightly confined within cages. If the measure passes, it would have far-reaching consequences for the egg industry, both in Massachusetts and many other states. And it would also mark a big win for the cage-free egg movement. But are cage-free eggs really all that much more humane for the animals or healthier for us human animals? Zach Coleman is an energy and environment reporter. He's currently a Knight Science Fellow at MIT, and he's written about the fight for cage-free eggs in The Atlantic. It's good of you to join us.
Thanks for having me, Barbara. I really appreciate it.
Well, what case do the proponents make for this ballot initiative in Massachusetts? Is it solely about humane treatment towards animals, or is it also about health and sustainability?
When I talked to the proponents of the measure, they overwhelmingly were talking about morality and treatment of the animals. But that's not to say that sustainability and human health don't come into this. I think that's been a very effective way in which animal welfare advocates have broadened the appeal of these types of measures. They talk about how it reduces the risk that disease would spread through tightly cramped quarters, like what we have in most egg production. And I think that has kind of expanded the interest. But if you ask opponents of the measure, they say that these people are just out to kill, you know, animal meat in the crib. They don't want anybody eating it at all. They just say they want to kill their industries.
And why is this initiative in Massachusetts and not some other more big ag or big food state?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people in Massachusetts. You look at the Boston area, that's a couple million people. So you have purchasing power here and a very liberal base where they're a little bit more primed to accept these kinds of ballot proposals. So the idea is that if you prevent the sale of cage-free eggs within Massachusetts, you affect purchasing power. And the ban would actually require producers from outside of Massachusetts to only sell cage-free eggs within the Commonwealth. So it could affect production outside of the Commonwealth in states that normally have pretty strong ag industries that might politically oppose restrictions on egg production within their own borders.
And Chris Green joins us now. He's executive director of the Animal Law and Policy Program at Harvard Law School. And welcome to you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
So how are they defining cage-free in Massachusetts? Because that's become a really broadly defined label. I'm not sure what it means when I see it on egg cartons here in my grocery store in California, which passed a similar measure back in 2008.
Yeah. So the way they do it for the Massachusetts measure is basically saying that the animals have to be allowed to fully extend their limbs, which mean extending all limbs without touching the side of an enclosure. In the case of egg-laying hens, it means fully extending their limbs, fully spreading both wings without touching the side of an enclosure, and having at least 1.5 square feet of usable space per hen. So the ability to stand up, turn around, and extend one's limbs.
So we're getting closer to a definition or a more standardized idea of what cage-free means with this ballot initiative?
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's really kind of defining confinement. So people who cage-free means sort of a lack of confinement. There's different ways people can be cage-free, but this is just telling you what you're not allowed to do, not telling you what you have to do to comply.
And why do you think this is happening in Massachusetts? Are there other factors that are contributing to this?
Well, there are. Yes, Massachusetts obviously is likely to be a sympathetic state, but it's not really. There's currently 24 states that allow ballot initiatives, including DC and DC. And Massachusetts and Maine are two of the only ones on the East Coast. So they've already hit a lot of Western states. Similar ballot initiatives have been passed in Florida, Arizona, and the big one was in California, which California is obviously one of the biggest ag states in the country. But in Massachusetts is one of the only ones on the East Coast, so that's why it was targeted as well.
Well, how do you see this playing out in Massachusetts? What are, for instance, food industry producers saying?
Well, they're obviously not happy about it, but it doesn't really affect as many in-state Massachusetts producers. I think there's only one battery cage producer, and I don't think there's anybody using gestation crates for sows. But even in California, you saw a lot of opposition to it, but it passed by the biggest margin that any ballot initiative has ever passed in the state of California. And I think that reflects just nationally how Americans feel about this issue. There's a poll that showed 94% of Americans agree with the statement that animals raised for food on farms deserve to be free from abuse and cruelty. The problem is just that producers have had no real consumer nexus, so they've had no incentive to change. So animal advocates have started targeting retailers and corporate actors, but also trying to pass this in the legislature. I mean, in Massachusetts, for the last four legislative sessions, 8 years running, animal advocates have tried to work through the traditional legislative process and get these protections passed because polling showed that the overwhelming majority of Massachusetts voters wanted it. But the ag industry does, exert quite a bit of influence on legislatures, especially on the agriculture committees that most of these issues have to go through. Well, so that's why they turn to the ballot initiative and just take it straight to the people.
Well, Walmart announced it was on board with cruelty-free eggs recently, indeed, right? How are the other big box purchasers reacting to this cage-free movement? And are they feeling heat from consumers?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's almost a daily basis for about the past year that you've seen large retailers or restaurants or food service providers. Right now, all three major food service providers in the country have made cage-free commitments. McDonald's was the huge one last fall. And as I said, you had these producers who were claiming this can never happen. But you go to a retailer like McDonald's, I mean, they're essentially just a marketing and delivery vehicle. They're not a producer. And as soon as they made their announcement, I mean, they sell 2 billion eggs a year just in the U.S. and Canada. The very next day, a large producer in Arizona with over 2 million hens said they're going to go cage-free. And then a couple weeks later, Rembrandt Foods, which is the third largest egg producer in the country with 15 million hens, they said they were going to go cage-free as well.
Well, energy environment reporter Zach Coleman, have we learned anything from the example of California from Proposition 2?
Yeah, a lot of the people I talked to for this story said Massachusetts ballot initiative is written much more specifically to hit at cage-free. So the California proposal didn't specify dimensions for confinement. So that law has kind of been abused. It went into effect last year, and the confinements are still a little bit cramped. There was an investigation by Direct Action Everywhere, an NGO that promotes animal welfare, went to a producer in California and saw abuse of the law, that it wasn't being enforced properly, and that's basically a loophole in the language. So this ballot proposal in Massachusetts actually specifies the dimensions for cages for hens. It would go to 1.5 square feet per hen. That's 216 square inches compared to the conventional battery cage, which offers 67 square inches. So pretty big size improvement for the hens.
Right. Zach Coleman, energy and environment journalist and a Knight Fellow at MIT. Chris Green, executive director of the Animal Law and Policy Program at Harvard Law School. We're going to end it there. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks again. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio National.